Hey there, it's Tom Ryan, founder and CEO of ICR. Before we get into the next episode, I wanted to ask that you subscribe to the show. It'll help us get even more unique and interesting guests on the podcast, and in turn, continue to educate management teams and the growing ecosystem that creates value for fast-growing private and public companies. And while you're at it, head over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a 5-star rating. Very much appreciated. This episode is brought to you by IEQ Capital, an investment advisory firm that provides a premier endowment-style investment approach and family office services to eligible clients tailored to the unique needs of your family. The founding team behind IEQ Capital are entrepreneurs at heart with an uncompromising focus on clients and investment excellence. With over 30 years' experience as investors, they have a broad understanding of each asset class, deep institutional relationships, and a network that provides assets to exclusive private investment opportunities. Visit www.ieqcapital.com to learn more. While neither I nor the show receives fees from IEQ Capital in connection with the sponsorship, nor am I a client of IEQ Capital, I must note the potential conflict of interest in recommending IEQ Capital in light of our potential for a future business relationship. All statements in this episode express the speaker's respective personal views and do not reflect the opinions or review of IEQ Capital.
To me, it was just an appreciation for how absolutely minuscule we are in our solar system, let alone our galaxy or the universe.
When you're not afraid to go the distance, there's no telling where that mindset can take you or what you can uncover.
We barely dipped our toe in the grand ocean of our solar system. So to me, it was a very energizing feeling that we have to get back out there. I'd like my daughters to see people walking on the moon, to see people walking on Mars, and to actually go out and see what questions we might answer.
Being a public company can be hard. Small missteps can have outsized consequences. I'm Tom Ryan, founder and CEO of ICR, and over the last 20 years, we've helped thousands of companies understand and navigate the stock market and the media. We'll demystify these and other increasingly complex stakeholder groups so you can focus on what you do best, building your company, and unlocking your true potential. This is Welcome to the Arena. If you've been to space and back, you're bound to have an amazing perspective about your own capabilities and what humans can achieve. Our guest today knows all about that. On this episode, we're sharing part two of Morgan Brennan's interview with Jared Isaacman, recorded in January at ICR's 26th annual conference in Orlando, Florida. If you didn't catch part one last week, I highly recommend you do so. Jared is an extraordinary business leader, and on top of his incredible career as the founder of Shift4 Payments and Draken International, he's an accomplished pilot and an astronaut. He's made significant contributions to financial technology, defense, and aerospace. Jared founded Shift4 in 1999 at 16 years old, and under his leadership as CEO, Shift4 has consistently pushed boundaries. Today, Shift4 employs over 2,500 people and processes $250 billion in payments annually for more than 200,000 customers across the U.S. and Europe. Apart from his extraordinary success with Shift4, in 2021, Jared made history by commanding Inspiration 4, the world's first all-civilian mission to orbit. That mission raised over $250 million for St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital, and later this year, he's going to return to space as commander of the Polaris Dawn mission. This is the first of three space flights under the Polaris program, which is a partnership with SpaceX, and we'll hear all about those missions in the next part of this interview. We're delighted to have Morgan Brennan as the co-host for this interview. Morgan is the co-anchor of CNBC's Closing Bell Overtime. Over the last 10 years, she's held various on-air roles with CNBC and was previously co-anchor of Squawk on the Street and Squawk Alley. Let's get back in the arena with Morgan Brennan and Jared Isaacman.
You've built and are running a public company. You've built and sold a private company. What's easier, being public or private?
It depends. In the bull market, you know, every press release, everyone's cheering, right? And I liken the bear market as you're riding a bicycle and there's people behind every bush ready to jam a stick in the tire. if you can visualize that. But yeah, to me, I think it's playing in the biggest, hardest, most challenging arena possible, and it's not supposed to be easy, or everyone would do it.
I'm going to ask what's next for Shift 4. We've talked about this in the last couple of months, because in the Q3 investor letter, you did acknowledge that you're actively exploring strategic opportunities and alternatives that will reduce distractions and serve our company, employees, and shareholders best. What does that potentially look like?
Well, I think that's really largely in the board's hands. But I guess I would say is that, as everybody knows, there is a cost to being public, and it's not just the overhead of it, right? I mean, we are forced, for those in the public company business here, we have to describe our strategy in incredible detail every single quarter, and not just once on an earnings call, but for the next 3 weeks thereafter with every investor who may very well have a position in one of your competitors that's going to take all that information back. I think that's an enormous cost. Like, we grow really fast. We've been growing our payment volume at like a CAGR of like 48% through the last 4 years, including through a pandemic. We're pretty good at taking share from the competition. And that's fine if you're being rewarded for the ultimate transparency, but it does come at a cost. And if it's not being valued, then I don't blame our board or myself as the largest shareholder for considering alternatives.
I do want to get back to the space piece of this before I open it up for questions, and that is best and worst parts of going to space or being in space.
I think the best and worst part is the same answer, and it's coming home. We were 600 kilometers above the Earth, orbiting at 17,500 miles an hour. I mean, pretty incredible, but I mean, you are a bullet at Mach 25 at that point. So, you know, at times can be in a stressful environment, and, you know, you comfort that by going back and seeing your family. So that's certainly the good part of it. The bad part is you're having an experience that only 600 people before you've ever had to see the Earth from such a perspective and shape your thinking. You kind of don't want it to end.
There was a lot of reporting we got back from Iteration 4 about the bathroom. It was probably overdone. But I mean, is there a certain question that you get asked more than others in terms of the curiosity about spaceflight?
Believe it or not, that doesn't even come up as anywhere near as often as I would have thought.
Good.
I think, you know, Elon was kind enough to tweet out the specifics at the time, so I guess everybody got all the details. But and for what it's worth, I mean, throughout all of human spaceflight history, the toilet breaking is like every mission. So it wasn't just us. I mean, there's 60 years of legacy there of those things failing. So anyway, I mean, other than that situation, which, by the way, like, we didn't even find out until after the fact that was actually the cause. We actually had a fire warning light that came on. It turned out it was a fan was truly shorting out, multiple ones, that actually drives how the system operates. But we were super well trained. We lived at SpaceX for 6 months for those circumstances, and everybody was still super happy, healthy, and productive throughout the 3-day duration of our mission.
So how are you training now?
So now it's totally different. This is a test and development program. So this will be the first new EVA or spacesuit for a spacewalk designed in 40 years. And it is a huge deal to leave the safety of a vehicle in a spacesuit. All your lines of defense are given up. So you now have to be insulated from massive temperature swings in and out of sunlight, you micrometeorite and orbital debris. I mean, just to give you a sense, like a 2-millimeter, you know, speck of metal that came off another satellite, maybe from a previous weapons test or something, like, will shred a spacesuit. Like, it'll go through a vehicle if it needs to. And you have to, in areas, build out some armor against it for safety. So there's a lot of things you are exposing yourself to, an increased radiation environment. And then you also want some redundancies just for your life support equipment, for oxygen. You obviously, there's big pressure differences. We're operating at, you know, 4.5 to 4.8 PSI. So it looks like on Earth, when we're wearing it, as a comfortable piece of cloth becomes like a structure, and it's incredibly rigid. So anyway, the development around that is the heart of this, of our training. I mean, we spend a lot of time suspended from the ceiling and, you know, kind of offload systems to simulate microgravity in our suit, all the contingencies of hatch failing or medical conditions. It's certainly much more intense, which is awesome. And then there's a lot of other modifications for going so high. As I mentioned, so far this we've gone since the last time we went to the moon, which puts you right at the Van Allen radiation belts. And there's a lot to learn there about vehicle architecture and just human physiology for being exposed to that radiation environment. And this is important because if you do get to Mars, you want to live to come back and tell everybody about it.
Would you go to Mars?
For sure.
While Morgan opened it up to take questions from the audience, they weren't always audible, so I'll jump in and share the questions. The first one was about how being in space has shaped the way Jared sees the world.
You know, seeing the Earth from that perspective, astronauts have referred to this for a long time as the overview effect. There's even a book about it. I have to tell you, to be like brutally honest about it, is I do believe that for the first, you know, decade or two of human spaceflight, a lot of the emotions that were shared from that experience about, you know, the thin blue line of our atmosphere and, you know, we have to take care of our planet and we shouldn't fight wars over lines that were drawn on the map and destroy our atmosphere and all that, like, I think that was all very genuine. And the reason is they never saw what the Earth looked like before they went there. We've had high definition video of what the Earth looks like from space for a long time. I don't think you need to go to space to know that we shouldn't kill each other or destroy our environment or fight needless wars. So I didn't have any of those more commonly expressed feelings about the overview effect. To me, it was just an appreciation for how absolutely minuscule we are in our solar system, let alone our galaxy or the universe. I mean, we were farther away from the Earth than humans had gone in more than 20 years, and it was no different in distance than going from like Pennsylvania to North Carolina. I mean, we were way out there, and that was a very small distance. It's, you know, it's 2.5 days to get to the moon. It's 24 hours with a lot of rendezvousing maneuvers to get to the International Space Station. It's 6 to 9 months, you know, to get to Mars. I mean, we have done nothing. We barely dipped our toe in the grand ocean of our solar system. So to me, it was a very energizing feeling that we have to get back out there. I'd like my daughters to see people walking on the moon, to see people walking on Mars, and to actually go out and see what we might uncover, what questions we might answer about our purpose or our existence, because there's a good chance they're out there. Not to mention, if you want to forget about all the, you know, it's in our DNA type thing to go out and cross the oceans, there's things that can totally change our trajectory here on Earth from an economic perspective. I mean, you could, you know, whether it's helium-3 or some other metal or element that we could discover that could create a new form of power, would change the entire geopolitical landscape that we've understood for the last 100 years. I mean, there is so much. And that's all I was really thinking about, is we just got to get going. We had some incredible momentum the first decade, and we really pumped the brakes for the last, you know, 50 years, and we got to fix that.
Do you like For All Mankind?
Yeah, what a great show. And I'll tell you, there's a reason for it too, which is they found a reason for us to be there, which is important because we don't know exactly what that space economy is. In that case, it was helium-3. When NASA became like a top-line revenue contributor to the government, like the most important agency and fleets of spaceships and all that, we will figure out a space economy. As Morgan knows, she covers them all. I mean, the amount of money that's gone into this industry, a brand new rocket launching last night, the cost to experiment and now innovate in space has dropped materially, orders of magnitude, to the point that we might figure something out up there that will change everything. So I love the show for that reason, because they figured out a reason why you need to have, you know, thousands of people in space. And I don't think we're that far away from figuring it out in reality.
One audience member wanted to know if there was ever a moment in the last seconds before launch when Jared thought that maybe this just wasn't a great idea.
That's an awesome question. By the time you're in the spacecraft and strapped in, it's about 3.5 hours before launch. We build in a lot of debacle time for things to go wrong. There's a lot of tests on the vehicle. You're sealing it up and you're doing leak checks on the suit. So you build in a lot of time. The reality is most of this stuff is done on time. So you're just sitting there for a while and you're looking at the countdown clock on your systems displays and you're like, I've got all this time in the world. But I'll tell you, when, you know, the clock starts to somehow speed up like exponentially, like, you know, 30 minutes, it's like, wow, this starts to move a little bit more. And then 10 minutes, it's moving really. And by the time you're down to like 10 minutes, the motors are lighting. So it just races by. And I think everybody on their first mission, there's a little bit of, you know, elevated blood pressure. I think I looked at that like any other more demanding flying I've done, which is you just got to hack it. And then I'd say like another concept we have in flying, which is always staying in front of the airplane, always, you know, anticipating what's going to come next and being prepared. You try and do that in a spacecraft and it does not work. I mean, in 10 minutes, you're idle to going, you know, 17,500 miles an hour orbiting the Earth, 10 minutes. I mean, it happens so damn fast. I mean, when we got on orbit and it's, by the way, you feel this continuous acceleration of the G-force and then it just suddenly stops and then you're floating. It was like, what am I supposed to do now? And it took like 10 seconds to catch up to how fast everything moves along. So that just happens really fast. Like it just disappears. And I'll tell you, when at ignition, it is not like you're getting thrown back in your seat. Vehicle's thrust to weight ratio is like barely better than 1-to-1 at that point. So it's not, I mean, hitting the gas coming off a stoplight in your car is going to throw you in the seat more than the rocket will initially. But I'll tell you, as you get, you know, closer to the first 2 minutes, 30 seconds before we throw away the first booster and it comes back and lands on a ship, you know, you've shedded a lot of propellant at that point. You're starting to build up speed. And then your last 30 seconds, when you're on the second stage, you've shed so much mass. It's now just four people in a spacecraft with 200 pounds of thrust on the last remaining engine and no atmosphere. You are moving and you're thrown back in your seat. It's pretty cool. But yeah, a little bit more benign off the pat, other than the anxiety of a controlled explosion that's about to take place.
The next question was focused on how Jared talks to his family about his space missions.
Well, that's a good question. I think I just told him I was going to do this. my wife and I have been together for, you know, like more than 20 years. I mean, she was employee 12 in the company way back when it was cool to date in the office. And so she's been with me my whole aviation career, of which I will say flying air shows is certainly more dangerous than going to space. And she believed that, and I believe that's wholeheartedly true. So that made that conversation a lot easier. Going back three more times was a different conversation. But my kids, you know, they just didn't think it was that cool. I mean, you know, for all they knew, they thought people were going to space every other day. I was showing them all the SpaceX live streams, which pretty much go off every day, except most of the time they're not people on it. But then, you know, The Mandalorian came out with Baby Yoda, and that totally renewed their interest in it. So I think they think it's at least reasonably cool now.
Another audience member wanted to know what it's like to come back to Earth after the experience of being in space.
So interesting. Once you're in the water, everything's great. So at that point, you're thrilled, excited that, you know, mission accomplished. And it was very, very emotional moment. I would tell you, though, that the 30 to 45 minutes prior to that point in time is without a doubt like the highest blood pressure period of the entire mission. So when you're going uphill on a rocket, you have a lot of outs. There's an entire launch escape system that will jettison the spacecraft and separate it from the rocket very quickly. And it's got, I mean, it's faster than I could ever move the handle. It'll detect anything that's anomalous and kick you away right away. And so you have a lot of safety nets on the way up. On the way down, you don't. You only have your heat shield. That thermal protection system that is now taking all that energy that the rocket put in and taking it out as you smash into the atmosphere, which creates that cool plasma effect around the vehicle. If the thermal protection system fails, then you fail. There's no plan B. There's no way through that. And we knew we were at a much higher altitude where our risk for micrometeorites was much higher. Just to give you a sense, the average risk associated with a NASA crew for 6 months on the International Space Station for something catastrophic happening from a micrometeorite, we had the equivalency. I won't give you the odds of that, but it'd be probably shocking to know how much little bullets are whizzing around up there. We had the same equivalent risk for 3 days on orbit. So we knew, and in the end, we actually took almost a dozen micrometeorite hits, but none of them were severe enough to damage the thermal protection. But that was on our minds coming back in the atmosphere. So we were very nervous about that. But once the chutes came out, and we landed in water, everything was good.
Someone else wanted to know whether you get shorter after going to space.
No. It's actually the opposite. You believe it or not, you get a little bit taller in space because gravity doesn't compress your spine, which is why most people report back pain in space, interesting enough, probably. But you return to your normal size minus a minuscule amount of bone mass that you shed.
We have time for 1 to 2 more questions, potentially.
No food questions in space? Isn't this the group for that?
Oh, that's right. You teased that earlier. Well, now you're going to have to just share it with us. What? Why was it so bad? How do you fix it?
I was trying to break the ice in the beginning. It was actually not so bad. There's no heating element. Anything that heats things up could be a fire hazard. So So basically, we had cold pizza and cold bagels. And interesting, the way we kept it cool is we're all coffee drinkers. I mentioned that before. So we froze coffee in like these water pouches that we had and used that to keep the pizza and the bagels cold through the duration of the mission. We had some really horrible stuff if we landed in like the Pacific. For like, we had these cubes. Like, one little cube has got like 10,000 calories in it, and it's a combination of like fish and kale and just really horrible. We had to try them. I was going to use them as bait to catch something worthwhile eating if it came down to it. But actually, the food wasn't so bad. But no heating element on our vehicle, so that kind of limits the options. But for this next mission, we're doing the same thing for 5 days. Lots of cold coffee to keep food reasonably fresh.
Okay. I'm just going to end it with this with you, Jared, and that's the fact that this picture is what a rendering of Starship, which is the new mega, uber-powerful rocket and transportation system that SpaceX has been testing and has attempted 2 launches of so far. You're going to be the first one inside this when time comes.
This is a huge deal. This is what's going to change everything, really. You know, imagine, you know, flying to Disney World here in Orlando and then you throw away the 737. Well, SpaceX at least stopped them from throwing most of it away. But the second stage, the last bit that we ride up into orbit, does get burned up in the atmosphere. An entire engine that's super expensive to build and part of a spaceship gets burned up. No one has built a fully reusable vehicle. This first and second stage will do that, and it has twice as much thrust as the Saturn V that put humans on the moon more than 50 years ago. It's a fully reusable launch vehicle that will eventually be able to fit 100 people in it. And this is what's going to bring NASA astronauts back to the moon. This is what's been contracted to do it. This is what's going to bring human beings for the first time to another planet in Mars. And there's 2 factories cranking these things out. I mean, these aren't one-offs. There's literally going to be hundreds of these. And you think about the applications. I mean, one of these has more habitable volume than the entire International Space Station, which took like a trillion, gazillion dollars to build. They could just dock 100 of these in orbit, and you basically have a city. So the potential for this is really extraordinary, and we're only probably a couple years away before the first human flights on it, which I'm super lucky. Well, that's the Polaris 3 mission, is to lead the first Starship flight to orbit.
All right, Jared Isaacman, thank you so much.
Thanks, Maria.
It's great to have you here on stage.
It doesn't get much bolder than that. Jared is a business leader with truly limitless thinking. He has highly successful ventures, and he proves that every day, from Shift4 to Draken International to working with SpaceX and setting his sights on Mars. It's pretty inspirational to hear from someone who looks past the boundaries and only sees opportunity. At Welcome to the Arena, we're working really hard to bring you exciting guests and great content. If you found this episode insightful, subscribe to the show on your podcast app and leave us a 5-star rating. The more the show grows, the more interesting voices we can have on the podcast. And in turn, that should demystify a lot of the stakeholders around public companies and soon-to-be public companies. Thanks for listening. I want to thank both Morgan and Jared for sharing this exciting chat. It was fantastic to feature Morgan and her stellar hosting skills on the show, and it was an absolute thrill to hear from Jared about his incredible adventures and the future of space travel. We will be watching what he does next from Earth. This is Tom Ryan. We'll see you next time back in the arena.
References to specific stocks are not intended to be recommendations for specific trading behavior. Comments presented on this podcast are intended for informational and educational purposes only, and do not represent opinions or recommendations on whether to buy, sell, or hold shares of a particular stock. All investors are advised to conduct their own independent research into individual stocks before making a trading decision. In addition, investors are advised that past stock performance is no guarantee of future price performance.
This episode is brought to you by IEQ Capital, an investment advisory firm that provides a premier endowment-style investment approach and family office services to eligible clients tailored to the unique needs of your family. The founding team behind IEQ Capital are entrepreneurs at heart with an uncompromising focus on clients and investment excellence. With over 30 years' experience as investors, they have a broad understanding of each asset class, deep institutional relationships and a network that provides assets to exclusive private investment opportunities. Visit www.ieqcapital.com to learn more. While neither I nor the show receives fees from IEQ Capital in connection with the sponsorship, nor am I a client of IEQ Capital, I must note the potential conflict of interest in recommending IEQ Capital in light of our potential for a future business relationship. All statements in this episode express the speaker's respective personal views and do not reflect the opinions or view of IEQ Capital.